A man walks into POP Fishing and Marine and he stands, staring and still. After a few minutes, the heavy perfection of machined metal speaks to him, and he reaches out his hand to a shiny chrome jethead trolling lure. This man owns no boat. He owns no fishing rod, no reel. But he picks up the chrome jethead fishing lure and carries it to the register, where he stands proudly. The woman at the register knows this man does not fish, but she smiles. She comes out from behind the counter, and she leads him across the store to the display of big green egg cookers. He reaches out his hand, and he lays it on the finely engineered top of an extra-large-sized big green egg. Suddenly, his face gains back the faraway look of a man who has been called by something powerful, and he turns to the woman from the sales desk, and he says, "I have an enormous backyard. POP Fishing and Marine. You want stuff that works? We got it. On Pier 38, next to Nico's."
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, come on in and catch some. As a matter of fact, let's talk about it. Let's talk about tuna. One of the things that I learned a long time ago when the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council first started a active sponsorship of our program is that how far-reaching the council was, how many people depended on their research and their practical application of science to figure out what we can or what we can't catch. And then I realized, talking to Dr. Paul Dalzell, who's a senior scientist at the council, a couple of years back, the council is really this huge, big organization that's all wrapped up around a tuna fish. And I mean, I know it sounds simplistic, but it, in many respects, it's kind of true. So what we're going to do today, as part of our getting you to know the council, is you're going to re-meet Dr. Paul Dalzell, the senior scientist, and also find out who the players are and what this big magic thing called tuna is. And who would have thought that we could convene a whole program, Dr. Dalzell, on tuna? But we can, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's got a long history with the council, and the facts are quite simple. 95% of the volume and the value of the entire Western Pacific region is tuna.
Now, there are a lot of kinds of tuna that we're going to talk about a little bit. But basically, when we're talking here in Hawaii, we have a local aku or skipjack tuna fish. And it seems now can document pretty much that we also have a local yellowfin tuna fishery. And who knows, maybe even kind of a big eye fishery. But for those that don't know, aren't there a whole lot of divisions of tuna?
Yeah, I mean, there's different stocks for sure. I mean, and it depends on, I think a lot of it's got to do with life history and lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
So across the entire Pacific, it looks like there's only one stock of big eye.
Mm-hmm.
But it's managed as two segments. One is in the west and one is in the east.
Now, of course, the fish don't know where they are at any given time. So the science changes because the fish change, right?
Yeah, I mean, but the yellowfin, the you mentioned we might have a local stock. Yeah, it looks like 80% of the yellowfin sort of that are born here stay here and breed here.
Yeah,
I think the big eye is a bit different. Its core habitat is really down on the equator.
You know, does that lend itself to why when most of the fish that they catch for the longline fishery, they're targeting a certain size. They want a larger fish because you certainly don't want the juveniles.
No, that's the problem is that the juvies are, if you're fishing around fads, you're going to catch a lot of juvenile big eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the great management conundrums right now, both in the east and the west. But what's interesting about our fishery is it fishes high latitude big eye, which tend to be big.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an idea that there may be, quite a reservoir of big eye at the high latitudes where not that much, relative to the rest of the...
To this point, we're not doing fishing that much up there.
Yes, right? Exactly.
But what I'm confused about, and I just don't know, I know, for instance, after talking as long as I have with some of the other pelagic fishery experts, that say a mahi-mahi, for instance, can grow from a fingerling to 20 pounds in a year. They very, 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 very quickly.
Yeah.
I don't think people... And when you take a look at a tree... Their science shows when you cut the tree down, count the rings, you can figure out how old it is. Isn't it amazing how some of the tuna can be around for a lot longer than people think?
Right, but you know, even then, you could say, well, skipjack probably got a 2 to 3 year lifespan. Yeah. Yellowfin, 10 years. Mm. Big eye, maybe 18 to 20, and then albacore. Beyond 20 years. Yeah. But they do grow very, very fast. Because the mahi is kind of like the fruit fly.
Oh, yeah. It's like a weed, right?
Yeah.
It just roars out of control. But what I think is kind of interesting, and many people don't relate to this, is that I remember back in the days of the late Mike Sakamoto, when he would catch the papio and kiss it and put it back in the water because we're going to make it be an ulua. Aren't there an awful lot of us that rely on a fishery and we don't care about the size? I mean, there's a lot of islanders that if there's a school of skipjack and they're all 1 pound and they can catch them, they're going to catch them.
Yeah, and generally with something like skipjack, you're relatively safe because it has what we call very high natural mortality anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, it's a food fish. I mean, it's a bait fish, really.
Right, but it, I mean, a lot of skipjack are going to die very early in their life. And so additional mortality from fishing doesn't really sort of push them very hard.
Interesting.
I mean, we're catching 1.5 million metric tons of skipjack in the Western Pacific. You know, half of all the skipjack that goes into cans is coming out of the Western Pacific. Two-thirds of all the skipjack that goes into cans is coming out of the entire Pacific. Mm-hmm. That's the Eastern Pacific. So, you know, we are the skipjack capital of the world in that respect.
And what is really amazing to me, and I remember talking with Peter Wilson about this quite a bit some time ago, is that the skipjack, the quantity of skipjack seems to be, when you talk about you're likely to find yellowfin at the juveniles at the fads, skipjack, they must run away from everything because they come in quite close sometimes because there's so much predation on them. What is skipjack the main menu for?
Oh, well, I would say certainly some of the big pelagic predators.
Yeah, or your marlin.
You have to say your marlin. Mm-hmm. Also sailfish. Mm-hmm. Also, I guess sharks, mango sharks. You know, the fish that can keep up with them. And other big tunas. I mean, one of the
in other words, it's equal opportunity food for everybody. I mean, come on and get them.
It's like, you know, large yellowfin will prey on small yellowfin, and large big eye will prey on small big eye. You know, you've got all that predatory biomass out there. It's gonna, and so it's not uncommon to have sort of like cannibalism.
I do know that it used to be, that's a great way to say it, that, you know, it's like they eat their young. Listen, when people are hungry enough, or fish, they're going to eat anything, whatever's on there. But what I think has always been amazing in the past, and maybe technology has eclipsed this thought, is that a lot of times, like skipjack, our own Aku fleet, for instance, before the cannery, and even after the cannery, they'd have to get that skipjack to processing pretty quickly because without proper ice and it doesn't travel well like other fish.
No, well, a colleague of mine once called it a floating blood clot, which kind of gives you the sense of you know, the urgency needed to get it into the either deep frozen very quickly or processed very quickly. Yeah.
I wonder how it was, Dr. Dalza. You can remember this. I know you've talked to a lot of people throughout the fishery. Is that before the big motherships were out there, the threat to the system wasn't very great because they couldn't deal with too much. They could only deal with so much fish at a time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the Aku fishery here in Hawaii, but I spent almost a decade working on Okinawan pole and line boats in Papua New Guinea.
Did they have the same emphasis on handling and ice then?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea was once you caught your catch, race back to the mothership to get it brine frozen.
Brine frozen,
yeah,
right away.
Yeah, absolutely. But the bigger issue, actually, and this is only for interest, really, it's not to do with Hawaii. Actually, it does have a parallel in Hawaii. Was the bait fish catch. You know, you have strong marine tenure in places like Papua New Guinea. So dealing with bait fish, you know, and royalty payments.
Yeah.
That was a real devil.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, how it affects the Hawaiian Islands. Because I remember back in the day when a lot of the Aku boats would have to go off Kahala and other areas to catch bait fish,
yeah.
to catch their fish. And this was, I guess they already have the sprays and everything else, but they actually needed that. And whether it was what species is whatever was there, I would imagine. That
well, the preferred was Nahu.
Yeah.
The anchovy.
Yeah.
And there's a nice paper by a guy called Jerry Weatherall at the Fisheries Science Center, which showed that Nahu catch, I think, in Kaneohe Bay was strongly influenced by stream outflow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And
fresh water.
I looked at it in Papua New Guinea, and it's actually a dome-shaped function. So a little rainfall's good, gets better, then you get to a peak, and you go over, and then it becomes somehow, maybe the water gets less salty, maybe it gets too cloudy, and the bait fish population or the bait fish catches go down. But the problem with Hawaii is access to bait fish. The greatest lagoon that we have in the islands is Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and it's pretty much decimated.
Off
limits.
I think it's a much more productive habitat than folks realize, you know. And there is a lot of bait fish in there, but it's off limits to the
commercial. Well, you know, what's happened to them is Pearl Harbor and the resources become, because of security and other reasons in the last several decades, something that you couldn't say, well, we're just in here catching bait, let us be, because you don't know who's doing this thing. But isn't it sort of also interesting, those of you that can remember this, and you talk about Nahu, it's a popular food fish. I mean, people like to eat Nahu, but they're not able to catch them and find them the way they used to be. Therefore, they think they're gone. And we've had such a change in our fishery that we no longer have these skipjack boats out there. Yeah. So that must mean that we're piling up skipjack a lot somewhere.
Yeah, well, you think about it. There was quite a big fleet here at the time of the cannery, and then the cannery went, and then there was the advent of new vessels like the Nisei, but, you know, I think right now there are less than three boats fishing, which means that it's confidential. I don't know the information about that. I believe the Nisei still fishes from time to time, but it has to make bait outside of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, which is tough.
And so the main catch of skipjack now is coming from our small boats, from the troll vessels.
Yeah, and that's pretty interesting. Every now and again when you're at the auction, you can see that when they do the trolling drop-off, when it's very, very high on that. But I think further that a lot of our local troll boats have really figured out the importance of handling. It used to be before you take the whole, you sell head, guts, and tail. Now if people catch otaro or good size skipjack in the 20-pound plus range, they're going to gut them. They're going to treat the fish. They're going to bleed them. They're going to gut them because they want the most per pound they can get.
Yeah, I think that's a message that's gone off around all the whole world over is that you need to take care of your catch. Be it bottom fish, be it skipjack, the handling of catch is really, really, really very important.
You know, I know that we often say amongst my guys, the Weekend Warrior guys, that, you know, a successful fishing trip is when you throw away ice, because that means whatever you caught, you had enough ice for.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that you come home with nothing and have a successful trip, but people don't realize, and it's become such a commodity. You need to have that ice, because if you're going to go further and further out to catch the fish, you better bring them in. Because back in the day, and you can explain how this happened, maybe the council knows more about it than I do, I'm sure, is that the auction has criteria for what comes in the back door. They're not going to want to take a fish unless they're reasonably sure that you handled it correctly from the moment you caught it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there are instances of the auction refusing fish.
Absolutely,
You know, sometimes it's one of those situations where maybe you get a glut and the boat's waiting to offload, and while they're waiting to offload,
Their fish is spoiling.
You know, it's... the auction is very careful. I don't want to, you know, speak for...
Well, I can remember, you know, because I'm one of the guys that used to bring fish to the auction back in the day. Everything got sold.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as rejected. There was somebody to buy everything. But then people got more and more, I don't want to say politically correct, but certainly health correct. Because you don't want to have somebody getting sick. Because now what happens is, look what happened recently in this hepatitis thing with the scallops. And is that everybody's looking for a lawyer.
You know,
it's not that I got an upset stomach, I think the fish was bad. I got an upset stomach, where's my lawyer?
Yeah.
You know?
There are a lot of standards, you know, that have been implied. And, you know, there are guys who can lead you through that maze, like Dr. John Kaneko, for example.
Yeah, what a gem this guy's turned out
Hawaii
to be.
Yeah, Hawaii Seafood Council. And he, you know, he's a very learned gentleman, but with a lot of practical knowledge about not just the handling, but also all of the bureaucratic red tape issues that you have to sort of run through.
I can tell you how impressed I've been with the tracking of the fish and the catch and the labeling by the auction. And I know a couple of processors, one right here in the neighborhood. He knows what boat the fish came from and when it was caught. And some of these processors, they wait for certain boats to come in because they like the way some skippers handle their catch. So it's become a science.
I saw a guy loading tuna.
Right here on the street.
Yeah.
Yeah, this guy is a processor that he's every morning he goes to the auction, then he comes back, and it just so happens to be he's kind of next to our building, and I talk with him a lot. And to see the care that goes in what they do, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, they have a truck full of ice.
Yeah.
You know, and you know that truck's only going to last a couple of years because it's going to rust out with all that salt water and all that ice.
Absolutely.
But it's sort of a planned deal. And I think, you know, there's something else that I think is really important. Even though I'm going to skip around here a little bit, we know that in some of the fishery, the longline fleet will actually go and provide one of our neighbor countries or islands income to be able to catch their big eye.
Yes, that's right.
And they don't even have the ability to catch the big eye themselves, but they can improve their fishery or their infrastructure based on that income. Maybe, I don't know if people here in Hawaii understand how that works.
The way it works is that when the WC, when the Western Central Pacific Fishery Commission enacted its conservation and management measures, it capped how much big eye the Hawaii fleet could catch.
Based on whatever science they were using at the time.
Yeah, based on, there was catch history. Yeah, it was used to formulate a limit.
Mm-hmm.
That limit is fairly low given the catching power of the fishery. And so what has happened is that the three U.S. territories, actually their catch was unlimited, but the council, as a precautionary measure, put a limit on their big eye catch of 2,000 metric tons.
Just to be safe.
Yes, and then enabled them to make a deal with the U.S. fishing entity, in this case the Hawaii Longline Fishery, to transfer 1,000 metric tons. And those funds then go back to that territory to help with improving the fishery infrastructure.
And what I like about that, folks, and Dr. Dalzell can explain it a little bit, but what I know of it, we can talk about something so simple as building a ramp, a launch ramp. We can talk about something so simple as facilitating the construction or a building for an entrepreneur that's going to make ice, have an ice factory. We're talking about people that can fix boats. We're talking about people that can make little skiffs. These are not longliners. These are quite the opposite of longliners. They're the inshore guys that are
getting
involved.
Absolutely, I mean, there is a longline fishery in American Samoa, and it targets albacore. So it catches a little bit of big eye, but not maybe 200 metric tons. And then Guam and the Northern Marianas, they're strictly troll fleets. But, you know, they all need infrastructure. They all can do with improvements. Just as a little news item, the Guam Fishery Co-op broke ground about a week ago to expand and improve its facility in Agana, in Guam.
And what is that facility?
It's the Guam Fisheries Fishermen's Cooperative.
Mm-hmm. And much like our auction, it's a common place where everybody, I guess, conspires to compete in the open. In other words, it's a management.
Yes, yeah. And also there are benefits to the co-op.
Sure.
Members, I think they get cheaper gas than they would.
That's an incentive.
That's a huge incentive.
Yeah, you bet.
Gas, and I think also ice too. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we were just talking about tunas. It's interesting to remember that originally when the Magnuson Act came out, tunas were specifically exempted.
Yeah.
And this council got tuna included in the Magnuson Act.
And by the way, isn't this a Magnuson Act review year?
It is. Yeah, there are rumblings, but you know,
It's not, it, from what I understand, it's not mandatory, but it's customary.
Yes.
You know, that every decade or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like 5 or 6 years that generally turn over a statute. But, you know, you can imagine in the early days of the council, it was left trying to manage tuna fisheries by having to manage the ancillary fish, you know, like the billfish, the mahi, the wahoo. Mm. Tuna inclusion was a huge achievement for the council, and the council then suddenly had it was a great thing to do, but then suddenly makes you realize, whoa, we got a big load of work ahead of us.
Yeah, and that being said, that's why we keep asking you to go to wpcouncil.org and look at the divisions and the amount of things that go on there. They're not generating reports and stuff for themselves. They're generating it for the industry. They're generating it for the fishermen. They're generating it for everybody, in it, particularly now our lawmakers. I'm hoping that as we look at some of these issues in front of the legislature this year that Roy Morioka and I were dealing with a couple weeks ago here on the program, is that, all right, the science being given to the decision makers, I seem to think that the council is a big part of saying, look, the science is a lot better than it's been. So we got to review some of our thinking based on the what we consider to be more accurate information about the fishery.
Well, I'm pleased to announce that very shortly we should be putting up the council's first pelagic fisheries safe report. Safe means stock assessment and fishery evaluation. Now we've always put out an annual report on the pelagic fishery,
right,
which basically comprises the core of which comprises modules from Hawaii, American Samoa, Guam, CNMI, a recreational module and an international module. But the safe report has more. It's more science. Yeah. You know, we're looking at what factors could be influencing production, and it's a requirement of actually Magnuson's national standard too.
Yeah, the thing I found interesting about that, Dr. Dalzell, was based on when we were all at the 168th meeting and the Fisher Forum that followed it a while back, we realized that the bottoms up way that the council tries to operate is that there are more folks in the trenches that are buying into the science, meaning, okay, we're starting to agree with you guys. Before, you used to give us some bogus, we knew where the fish was, you didn't know. It seems to me that there's more of a meeting of the minds as to, I don't want to say admitting to, but owning up to the fact that, yeah, we have to have rules and we have to have limits and we have to have closures in order to have the sustainability, that the science would support that.
I think Hawaii may be unique in the fact that it has, you know, the fishermen that really understand they get the science, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know when we've had meetings and people from the mainland come, and there's a big fishermen's meeting, say, you know, like a fishers forum, sure, or a public scoping meeting, they're amazed that there aren't security guys, you know.
yeah really, I
there's not guys drunk and howling and shooting off their mouths, but it's all very polite. People make comments, they make very strong comments, but it's polite and well received. And I think there's also a greater incidence now of fishermen collaborating with scientists. The Pacific Island Fisheries Group, I think.
Yeah, I think they've really shown. And here's another thing. And I picked this up because, as you know, I've been participating in some of the panels for the last several of the meetings, is that it most people don't understand how specifically dependent on fishing our Pacific is. Because on the mainland, if there's no fish, no problem. You just go buy something else. Mm. But we don't have that opportunity sometimes. And so sometimes our fishermen are saying, don't even think about regulating us. You can't regulate us. This is what makes us. And we self-regulate. And I think in some respects, that's kind of happening a little bit. When somebody gets their hook in the water and the tuna comes up and it's 1 pound, they say, let's not catch these. Let's go somewhere else.
Well, I know that happens in American Samoa, that they catch small big eye. They say, well, you know.
Yeah, stop.
Throw it back.
Yeah.
It's more value to me when it's a big fish, you know.
Yeah, but that's a mentality. You mentioned something before that I think people would like to know about. It seems to me that when we have albacore here, tombo, that they're in a larger fish.
Yeah.
We don't see baby tombo. Now, I do know that every now and again, because I fish the fad sometimes, you can pull a bunch of tombo off a fad, but they're always somewhere between 50 and 70 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Where basically, if you want to see juvenile tomboat,
yeah, where are the babies?
You got to go higher latitude.
Oh, okay.
So latitude like Japan or New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
that's where you'll get surface trolling, yeah. and pole onlining, and even purse seine fishing. The Japanese have all three surface types of yeah. fisheries. You won't see small tomboat in the subtropical and tropical latitudes.
What I think is amazing is, when you take a look at it, here in Hawaii anyway, tombo is not as prized as a skipjack or as ahi or as big eye because of the oil content. There must be something a little bit different. The people in the Middle West, they prefer, they'll pay more money for albacore because it's not as greasy.
Well, not as greasy, but
we want the greasy stuff here.
It's also white flesh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've always wondered why albacore wasn't as popular. Mm-hmm. But like you say, I think it's with respect to tunas. I mean, you know, when you watch that Wicked Tuna show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Watch one of the things they always say. Oh, nice fat content.
Nice fat content. Nice yeah. and oily. Big fat one.
Oily yeah. fat. Yeah. You know, it's the oil in the the flesh, which really determines the taste and quality and texture of sashimi.
Everybody thinks that watches that show. And as you know, we've had the skippers and a lot of the players on this program time and time again. I really enjoy it. There's some new guys in there that are really, really down to earth. They're real. You know, they don't know how much longer this series is going to go on. This is kind of real stuff. It's a lot more boats involved in the fishery than we see on the program. We follow five or six or eight boats. But the fact is that they know that the desirability of that fish is outside of their market. They're not eating their fish. They're selling it because it's a lot of money.
Yeah, it all goes to Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and it's testament to the ingenuity, I think, of fishermen that, you know, these big, they're the only way they can catch these fish commercially is using recreational type methods.
You know, that's really something interesting, because they have a rule on that show. Everybody knows it. 73 inches is, I think, 72 or 73 inches. They call them a short, right?
Yeah.
But they have the ability, they know, to let that fish go.
Yes.
And what we don't see, I mean, what we see on television, the fight being very quick. Some of these tuna are on the line with these guys for an hour or longer.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah. Some of those are so big.
Some that's so big. However, they know enough when a short comes in quickly, because it's small, can't fight the gear.
Yeah.
But they know how to get that fish released, and they really do it.
Yeah.
That's why their observers are the cameras, you know, that we see on the show. But aren't our guys equally as under the magnifying glass with our observers that are on our longline boats?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have 100% coverage on the swordfish shallow set fishery, 20% on the deep set, and you know they're recording a really big amount. God, I'm getting big amount, a significant amount of data, and they're reporting the conditions for a shark, for example.
Sure,
we don't have a shark market as such in Hawaii. Oh, it's very small. Mm-hmm. So when the sharks come in, quite often the fishermen will try and just shake them off.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But if they can't, then they'll have to cut and, you know, leave trailing gear, which is unfortunate. But, you know, sharks are tough creatures.
Incidentally, that's another thing. A lot of us that are trollers know that we like the shiny hooks. We don't like rust. The fishery uses a hook, a circle hook, that will rust out.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's planned to do that, right?
Yeah.
So in other words, when you cut that fish loose, it may seem, well, that's cool, it's going to die. It's probably not.
No. And also, I should mention that the hooks that they use in the deep set fishery are also there's a minimum wire gauge that they have to be, because the idea is that if they catch a false killer whale, then the hook will straighten. You call it weak hook technology.
Yeah, weak hooks, right.
So a hook is not just a hook.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hook that rusts out. It's a hook that that may straighten if you catch a big animal like a false killer whale.
Those of you that haven't been down to the to Pier 38 here on Oahu, depends on where you listen to the program, you can't imagine, you can't believe the amount of time the crew spends on the gear, on redoing hooks. They really, because if you have a bad hook, you lose a fish, you've lost a ton of money. You got a good hook, but you also want a hook that knows what it's supposed to do if you cut it loose.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to make a point that there's a lot of hyperbole about these longliners, they have 3,000 hooks.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, yes, they have 3,000 hooks, but if they catch 5 to 10 good.
That's a good set, by the way.
That's a good set. Yeah.
That's so hard for people to understand because most of us that have like our weekend trollers, we got seven lures that we're dragging.
Yeah.
You know, and these guys, what do you mean you got 1,000? Well, first of all, they're spread out over a long period of time, and sometimes you can pick up 2 miles of it without a fish on it.
Oh, sure.
Or more.
Watch. There's plenty of video you can watch that shows that those long lines are coming back. Either empty or they got sort of, fish that are going to be discarded.
Yeah, and bycatch and all this stuff. By the way, gang, one of the things you want to do when you go to WPCouncil.org, you can search for this and other episodes of the show, but you can also see some nice videos on the different methods. And I said earlier, sort of in teasing Dr. Dalzell, who, by the way, our guest is the senior scientist for the council, is that it's a council based around a fish, the tuna fish. In some respects, I want to say that's starting to sink in with me. It's pretty true. We are a tuna fishery, and the quicker that we understand that, the more likely we are to agree at least on that species.
Yeah, I have a joke with my colleagues and say tuna is everything.
Yeah.
Everything else that we deal with is just stamp collecting.
Yeah, that's really funny. And by the way, we're getting more and more attuned to the relationship between the council and the Department of Land and Natural Resources. Those of you that don't understand this, that listen to the show all the time, have to understand that we have a very true line drawn around the islands, inside of which is DLNR, outside of which is council.
Yeah. I mean, there is a 3-mile boundary, which is the territorial boundary for the United States. Some places have it 12 miles, like Puerto Rico, but generally the territories in the states, the coastal states, is 3 miles. That's the preserve of the local legislatures. Yeah. And then 300 to 200 and the high seas beyond. That's the jurisdiction of the council.
What I like about it is the interplay between the agencies has improved to the point where everybody's sort of watching out what everybody else's kuleana is. I do know that this year there's likely to be at the legislature on Oahu or in Hawaii, and then going to the federal government, an opportunity to present wavering views on what should and shouldn't be fished, particularly around the monument. I know the council is spending a lot of time on that, hopefully there are some receptive ears that will listen to reason in some of it. I think it's safe to say that the council feels like there should be a way to be able to create two things. One is to have a monument, and the other is to maintain a fishery.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, 2/3 of Hawaii's EEZ is closed off now to commercial fishing.
And that's a very, very big piece of property, my friends.
And what are the benefits of that? Mm. Well, you know, if you think about even the previous monument when it was just a 100-mile, it was 50-mile either side of the
Papahanaumoku you're talking about. Yeah.
The original monument. Well, that's all the real estate for the shallow water species and the bottom fish. But we didn't find ourselves up to our armpits in bottom fish flowing over from that closure.
Yeah, this is very interesting, friends, and this is why it was a sorry situation in at the end of the Obama administration when the council has put forth a number of letters, several, I think, that didn't really get responded to properly or at all in some cases, and that would indicate that maybe there was a quick assumption, well, we better do this. This is good for everybody. And maybe it's not good for everybody, and maybe certain of this has got to be looked at. And hopefully with that open-minded legislature or Congress, we can get this looked at.
Well, I mean,
it's not just Hawaii, is it, Dr. Doug?
No, there are monuments in American Samoa. Yeah. Most of the Priyas are all wrapped up now in monuments. There's only two where you can go and still commercially fish. And, the Priyas, the Pacific remote island areas. And the Marianas, the top three islands of the Marianas are all like that.
And by the way, we're getting momentum and gaining some understanding in other places on the west coast of the United States, on the east coast. It's not specifically to Hawaii. President Obama made this deep swath of a lot of things.
Yeah.
And some of them are probably perfect. Some of them are probably needed. But some of them also, we need to not have it a mausoleum that you can't open up anymore.
Well, we came up with an option for where you would have a big monument, but still have fishing. You know, it was like having your cake and eating it. It was still a big area, but not as big as the current monument is.
Yeah, so hopefully there's a medium point. Well, I think that did you kind of get an idea what we're doing today? Dr. Dalzell and I try to get you a little bit used to some of the players and everything else. And there's going to be ongoing concerns and ongoing meetings. But remember, it's all about the tuna. Dr. Dalzell, thank you. Nice seeing you again, my friend.
Thank you.
Okay, and if you want to know more about this and other programs, join us on the line, on web, wpcouncil.org, wpcouncil.org. Next week, we're going to talk about some scholarships that are available. This is exciting stuff from the council. We're going to tell you about that next time. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. See you next time.